Before we start today's show, we just wanted to share some exciting news with you all. We've launched our own Patreon page. Your donations will help with costs of producing and bringing you a show with better content such as on-site visits to prisons, prison phone calls, interviews, and much, much more. For only $6, you get a pros and cons sticker and pin, a Patreon exclusive episode every month. This could be a Q&A, interview with a special guest, update to a previous case, and a shout out on our social media and your name added to our website as a contributor. It also includes access to our private Slack group where you can get behind the scene updates like upcoming episodes, inmate artwork sent to Bethany, and then you can just chat with us and other listeners. Head on over to www.patreon.com/mouthoffnetwork and select the pros and cons tier to become a patron today.
This week on the pros and cons, we explore a multifaceted case that investigates the mental illness in the criminal justice system. We have a special guest, Kyle Holbert, joining us to give us insight into this important issue. Please note, this is part two from our previous episode. We encourage you to listen to episode one to give you context into this interview. Also, please be advised that this episode contains strong language and a discussion of mental illness. This is From Prison to Promise.
Hi, we're the Pros and Cons, two true crime television producers, Bethany Jones.
That's me.
And Adriana Padilla. That's me. With each episode, we talk to the pros that lived and worked the cases and to and about the cons that made headlines. We'd like to start off by thanking our new Patreon supporters, Zoe N. and Yolanda C. Your generous contribution helps us bring you even greater quality stories. The Pros and Cons podcast is available on all major podcast platforms and wherever you listen to podcasts, including TuneIn, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or other platforms, it helps other true crime listeners find us.
Or if you simply tag us on social media.
This is the second part of a two-part episode that we're doing, which is very new to us. And if you want to learn more about this case that we are talking about in this interview, which is interview-driven, you can listen to part one for the specifics.
Part one has no interview. We just talk about the case, talk about our producing of the case, how we found it. Part two, we have this exclusive insight, and I have to say I felt it was particularly raw and vulnerable and human.
Yeah, so without any further ado, this is our interview with our special guest, Kyle Holbert.
Kyle, hi, it's Bethany.
Hi, Bethany, how are you?
I'm well. You are on in the studio, or we call it our world headquarters. I have Adriana with me.
Hi, Kyle, how are you doing?
Hi, Adriana, how are you?
I'm doing great.
So, well, I'm a little nervous, but excited.
So, Kyle, why don't you take a moment and introduce yourself? You know, Adriana and I obviously, well, I know you especially, but, you know, take a moment to introduce yourself.
Let's see. My name's Kyle Holbert. I'm 36 years old, I think. 35 or 36. It's hard to keep up. I have an ongoing war with the dust bunnies under my bed, and I'm currently doing a life sentence in Virginia.
Okay.
How's that sound?
However you want to introduce yourself is fine by us.
This is the first time I've ever done this, so I'm a little nervous, to be honest with you.
So this is the first time you've ever spoken about your case with anyone?
I've spoken with other people about my case. This is the first time I've ever actually had an opportunity to actually tell my story without having to worry about spin and, you know, ratings and the other thing that the media jackal whores can't, you know, resist going after.
Right. Well, why don't we start? And I'd like to know a little bit about your childhood. It's my understanding you kind of bounced around from foster home and didn't have a lot of stability. Is that accurate?
More than accurate. My first hospitalization was when I was 6 or 7, but by then I was already on adult level antipsychotics. I didn't actually enter the foster care system until after I was about 11 or 12. Before then, I was bouncing between my grandparents and my father, my biological grandparents on my mother's side, and my biological father.
Okay.
That was a lot of back and forth, a lot of turmoil I had between my first hospitalization and 2001. I had over 28 hospitalizations.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's really quite a steep number.
Yeah, I spent the week leading up to this interview going over the reports and things that I have, the records that I have, and that was one of the things that was pointed out, that it's been 28 different hospitalizations between 86, I think, and 2001.
What were some of the challenges you were facing in getting treatment, and why were you being bounced around so much?
Well, largely, you have to understand that, you know, mid to late 80s, 90s, you know, there wasn't the knowledge of, you know, ADHD, manic depressive, bipolar, schizophrenia, and all that stuff, mm-hmm. the way it's known now. Now it's part of everyday language.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, they had no idea what the hell was wrong with me. I mean, you know, I've not been able to get a justifiable reason for why I was on the medication I was on starting at the age of 3, you know, and, you know, it was, nobody really knew, they didn't, and when I was being hospitalized, a lot of the time it was, I'm in the place, I stay there for a couple months, I go through the meetings, the discussions and stuff, and they give me medication and send me back home.
Okay.
That was really the large way it was, and that didn't help, you know, because nobody really understood what was going on, and the more they were figuring things out, you know, the worse I was becoming, because the psychoses were setting in, you know, they were developing as they were trying to figure them out.
Did you ever get an official diagnosis?
Several, actually. The prevailing diagnosis that I have is manic depressive, ADHD, bipolar, you know, schizoaffective disorder, borderline which is like borderline personality disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and delusions of grandeur, hypomania, things of that nature. You know, your usual mixed bag of what the hell.
Okay. Have you been able to receive treatment since?
No, unfortunately. You talking about since my incarceration?
Yeah.
No, that's not a... the mandate in the Virginia Department of Correction is security, not therapy.
Yeah.
They give you medication, and if you don't if you're not able to cope or maintain, you end up in the hole, which just makes you much more stressful living environment and doesn't help you at all.
Can you tell us what the hole is?
The hole is a single cell in a, it's a specific pod of like 40 cells, I think. You're in a cell by yourself and you're locked in there 24 hours a day. No commissary other than basic hygiene and postage, and no TV, no radio, nothing. Not since I've been here. I'm actually happy to say I'm 7 years charge-free and actually in the best pod on the compound I can be.
Okay.
They have something called a positive behavior unit that's only for inmates who have been maintained infraction-free behavior for a certain amount of time. So I'm lucky in that respect.
Keep up the good work. That's, really positive to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And both Bethany and I have mental health issues in our families.
Yeah.
So we completely understand how inappropriate that kind of treatment is for any kind of treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you tell me what role do you think that mental health played in your case?
Oh, gee guts. A huge role. The short of it, one thing, you and I have discussed this, is I hate the idea of blaming what happened on my mental health. It's, it's not my fault. I was sick. That's such bull. Yes, I was sick. Yes, I was unable to distinguish right from wrong, and that my psychoses led to this happening. At the end of the day, it's still my responsibility. It's still, I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tragedy. It never should have happened. Unfortunately, largely, it was a combination between my being let off my, let out, when I turned 18, they gave me a 3-month prescription of medications and a bus ticket home, to where I wanted to go. And that was it. No, overwatch, no supervision. And then I met Clara and things went to hell.
What would you do differently if you were given a chance to get in a time machine and go back?
Well, that's a tricky question. Obviously the popular answer is say, well, none of this would have ever happened, but if I went back with the exact same information I had back then, the sad fact is nothing would have changed.
Right.
It's easy to say, I would have gone back done things differently, but if you went back the exact same person, you're not going to change.
Right.
You have no impetus to. If I went back now, the smart answer would have been, call the cops and tell them what was going on with Claire and her dad and let them deal with it, The thing is, honestly, as much as people might not like to hear this, I'm a better person now than I ever would have been. Because I was a time bomb waiting to happen out there. There was no way I was supposed to be on the street back then.
Okay. What do you think to have happened?
What do I think was supposed to have happened?
Or should have happened, maybe.
They should have kept me locked. They should have kept me in a psychiatric facility until they were sure that I could handle myself.
Okay.
It's one thing for me to show positive behavior over the last 3 months, which was their impetus. I wasn't showing any psychotic symptoms at the time. This is at 18 years of old age when I've been locked up in psychiatric facilities since I was 7, off and on, and almost consistently since I was 12.
Okay,
this is a kid who has been on adult-level antipsychotic medication they were given to schizophrenics, starting around the age between 3 and 5.
Mm.
I had no life skills. I didn't know the first thing about paying bills. I didn't know anything about taxes, any of that. They let me go knowing I had nowhere to go but crashing at some friend's house. I had no job. I had no prospects. The smart thing to do, the responsible thing to do was to make sure that I, whether I liked it or not, keep me where I was or move me to an adult facility until they could be sure that I knew what I was doing when I got on the street.
Okay.
There was no way I was... My biological father, me and him had not had much contact over the years since he relinquished custody when I was 10, 11, and gave me to my grandparents. But I found out after the fact that he'd been keeping tabs on me the entire time. Every time I was put in a psychiatric facility, he knew about it. Every group home, every foster home, he knew exactly where I was. Before I was released, before I was emancipated in 2001, he fought the psychiatric board. He called them and raised hell. He went to war with them and told them, don't let my son out. He has no way to care for himself. He doesn't know the difference between fantasy and reality. And back then, I would have argued with it. Him and anybody else who got in my way was like, I know what I'm doing. I'm okay. But he knew.
Yeah.
And
do you have a relationship with your father now?
Unfortunately not. When I was in Loudoun County, when I was in the county jail, he came and visited me every week, like clockwork, never missed a day. And we were developing a rapport. And after I was convicted and sent to, the Department of Corrections, the actual prisons, about 9 months later, he just stopped answering the phone, stopped writing, and I haven't heard from him since.
Aww.
A couple years ago, I had one of my friends reach out to him on Facebook and send a letter that I wrote for him. To him, and he unfriended her and never responded.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. But this sounds weird. I know it does. But of all the people in my life, my dad was the one person who earned the right to walk away, to give up, because he went through hell with me. I mean, it has got to be, I can't even imagine how scary it is to have a child that you can't help, that you don't have an answer for, he said to my psychiatrist before, when I was, under the age of 10, that he was scared, to go to sleep some nights thinking that he was going to wake up and see me standing over him with a knife. He was scared what I might do to my younger brother or sister because of how messed up I was back then. To fight that hard and for so long and then for me to end up doing what he knew was going to happen all along if I wasn't helped. That has got to be terrible.
Yeah.
So I don't hold any animosity to my father for finally giving up. I don't. Okay. I can't.
Okay.
He did everything he could. He did everything a father could, and it wasn't enough. And I can't imagine what that did to them.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't live, Bethany, you've known me for a little over a year and a half. Now, I'm not a person who lives with a lot of regrets.
Right.
My father's one of them. My father is definitely one of them that I didn't know how to help him help me.
And honestly, it's not really your responsibility alone because it's like you can't help yourself either.
You don't know the language.
You don't know the.
Ask.
And also, it's like you're a person with an illness.
Yeah.
It just hits close to home.
Yeah.
Just because, Bethany and I can both say we've struggled with the same, and there's just no support for the family and even less for the person who has a mental illness.
Yeah.
So what are your hopes and goals now? I mean, I know that you're serving a sentence. What is your life like now?
Currently, I'm not in, my prison isn't the horror show that most, TV and media would have you believe that prisons are. I mean, it's not like, getting beaten down by the officers every day and, fear of being raped every second of your life. But it's an incredible isolation. That's the biggest thing. A lot of hopelessness. There's a lot of hopelessness, and that's for any inmate. I have a life sentence without the possibility of parole. Virginia does not have parole. I filed a habeas corpus on the grounds of ineffective assistance of counsel because of all the mental health aspects. Like, everybody who looks at my case asks me, why are you still in prison? Why did you ever why weren't you placed in a psychiatric facility? And I'm like, that was my lawyer's job, and I can't answer that. The habeas corpus ultimately failed. And I only found out with 6 months left in the deadline that I actually had a Supreme Court, a federal habeas I could file, and that never got filed. My lawyers didn't even tell me I had a federal habe available to me. So really, I don't really know what my options are right anymore. I'm hoping I can get a change in my sentence, to go to the governor or something and try to get, I'm not looking to get set free. I mean, that is a completely unrealistic goal, and I don't even think it'd be appropriate. I'm looking, hopefully, my ultimate goal is to get placed in a psychiatric facility where I can get treatment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because this place doesn't provide treatment. This place doesn't. I told a couple months ago, last time I saw my psychiatrist, I told her that I was having trouble recognizing my own face in the mirror. That sometimes I can't even see it, and sometimes I'm certain that the damn thing is watching me move and it's not in sync with me. Mm-hmm. Her exact response, verbatim, well, that sounds like something that you're going to need some intensive therapy for. You're not going to get it here.
So that's what you're...
Okay, this is...
Yeah.
That's what my psychiatrist said. The woman who prescribes my medication told me that I need to acknowledge that I'm having a problem, that I'm going to need some intensive therapy for it, but I'm not going to get it here.
Right.
They're not going to do anything about it.
Right.
There are nights where I wake up and I'm biting my knuckle because if I don't, I'm going to scream.
Mm.
It happens. You know what I'm saying? My choices are endure and get through it and suffer, or go to the hole where things will be worse.
Yeah.
There's no better option here. At least in the pod that I'm in, I've got brothers here who know, who are like family to me, and they know what goes on in my head, and they keep a watch on me. So if I start getting out there, they'll tell me flat out, Razor, you need to go back to your cell.
Mm-hmm.
They'll tell me, go to your cell, chill out for a while. We'll see you at cell break.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's really the only option we have.
Mm-hmm.
They're the only support system that I have here. I have pen pals that write to me that I, saying that I can talk to about the problems going on. I have a few people that I can call. And that's what I have. This is not treatment. This isn't therapy. This is store me in a warehouse until I die.
Mm-hmm.
This is a lot harder than I thought it would be.
Oh, well, take a moment. Take a breath. It's okay.
I didn't feel any of this coming up to today. The last couple weeks when you said you were going to call in, I was like, okay, I've got this. And then, I get on the phone and it's like, I'm fighting to keep from breaking down this whole time.
Yeah. I can hear it in your voice. I can hear it. Are there other people in there suffering from the same ailments and things as you? Is this common? And if so,
you have 1 minute remaining.
That disembodied bitch is a bane of my existence. I'm going to call you right back.
Thanks, Kyle.
Bye for right now.
All right.
Hello, this is a prepaid call from...
I am the Kyle.
An inmate at the Virginia Department of Corrections.
Okay. Where were we?
How many other people are suffering from the same ailments as you? And if so, is this common? How many people are there?
I can't speak to the entire prison, obviously, the entire prison system, but in my prison alone, I've seen, several guys. Unfortunately, there's a lot of guys who have, mental illnesses or at least behavioral problems, mood problems and stuff that just want medication so they can try to get high. That's why the formulary is fracked up as it is, because they have to take off the stuff that people abuse.
Right.
Which is why I can't get the medication that actually worked on me. There are several guys that I've seen who are broken, and barely functional, but they, because they're able to, and I know it's going to sound vulgar, but because they're able to wipe their own ass, they don't see anything, the people don't see anything wrong with them. They're
right.
Functional enough to take care of themselves, therefore leave them be.
Yeah. Well, let's shift gears a little bit.
Okay.
and kind of move back in, to the case. And,
okay,
you know, have you ever thought about what you might say to Dr. Schwartz if you had the opportunity to speak to him today?
Yes. I'm sorry, Bethany. That's a bit of a left hook. honestly, I don't know what I could say to him. I mean, I'm sorry doesn't even begin to cut it. You know? I mean, something like, what do you say to somebody like that? You know, that you did that to? Yeah. I mean, there's nothing, there's no words that could possibly ever, you know, make up for anything. There's no actions. What happened to him should never have happened to any person. Okay? And I am, you know, I am so, so sorry that it happened to him, to his family, to all the people that were affected by it, the people that whose his work could have saved. Mm-hmm. You know, I sat back one day and I tried to make a list of the people that were affected by what happened. I got about 3 pages into it and I had to stop. I mean, I couldn't write. My hand wouldn't stop shaking. I couldn't stop shaking. And I didn't leave myself for about 3 days. I just curled up in a ball and laid there. You know, because just the sheer effect of what happened was just so freaking overwhelming.
Mm.
You know, there was nothing. People think, I was asked a question not too long ago, like, can one person significantly change the world? And the answer is definitely yes, when you start looking at how interconnected everybody is and how your actions affect other people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, honestly, what can you say to somebody that would ever explain or make up for that, for what happened? You know?
Mm-hmm.
If I spoke to Dr. Schwartz today, I mean, you really, there's nothing that can really be said. I don't want to say, I'm sorry that I killed you because I was psychotic. That's not right. You know, I'm not going to shift blame on what happened because of, you know, my psychosis. I'm not going to shift blame, throw the blame on Clara, even though she manipulated me, you know? And that doesn't make up for it. That doesn't make it right. It's still my fault. I still did it, no matter what legalese you want to throw at it, no matter what justification or explanation that people want to throw at it about me being sick or Claire being a sociopathic, manipulative mastermind or whatever, that doesn't change what I did. At the end of the day, I killed a man who was doing great work in this world. Ironically, the stuff that he was working on was stuff that I was always fascinated by, stuff I wanted to get into. You know, I had, you know, fucking pipe dream of, you know, being able to get into, you know, science and biotechnology that, you know, and I never knew it. I didn't know what he was doing until, you know, what he would, like, what his life was about until years after he was dead.
Until after the fact.
You know, and it just... You know, and I don't know if the family's ever going to hear this, but the one thing that I always try to get done to the few people that I did interview with before, they lied to me outright, and they never did what they said they would do. And I hope that you'll air this to the family of Dr. Robert Schwartz and all the people that were affected by it. I am sorry. I know that the words mean jack all to you, but I just hope they know that I'm not living easy by this, and I never will. I am sorry from the bottom of my soul for what happened, and I wish with all of my heart that if I could change one thing in my life, is that I never met Clara Schwartz.
Have you been in contact with her ever since the trial, or do you know anything of her, or is she out of your life?
She's out of my life. I did hear from her several years ago, through a friend of mine, you know, reached. I was having a mental and spiritual crisis, and I was telling one of my closest friends about it, and she wrote to Clara with the questions I had. It was like one of those rhetorical things. I was like, you know, venting my friend.
What questions did you have for her? Are you, if you're comfortable?
I mean, I told you I would tell you, you know, I wouldn't hold anything back. One of the things was, if all of this was, you know, say, just some made-up crap that she did, that she wanted him dead, which all the records seem to indicate that, you know, that all the stuff she said about how he was abusing her wasn't true. Why would you make that? How can you hate somebody so much that you would make that up? And not just make it up, but use the people around you who genuinely care about you to cause this to happen and ruin so many people's lives. You know, what kind of thought process exists inside your head that causes you to go get gigs and gigs of child pornography that looks like you to download to your own father's computer to justify some half-assed attempt to justify what was going on to support your claim that he was abusing you? I mean, how can you do that? By all accounts, by anybody's account who knows me saying has ever examined me, I am a profoundly screwed up person in the head. When I'm not on my medications, even when I'm on my medications, I'm edgy at best. You know, I try very hard to. God, this is going to sound so stupid, but I want to live as normal a life as possible, accepting that I am never going to be normal. You know, I want to make the best of a bad situation. Okay. Am I ever going to be that, you know, white picket fence, you know, 2.5 children? No. Okay, you're never going to have me on your neighborhood committee. That's just not going to happen because my, you know, Dayglo, you know, painted house is just going to piss everybody off. You know, but when I'm medicated, I can look at the behaviors I've done and see, okay, that's not right. And there are some of the more extreme aspects of my mindset that even when I'm going through, I'm like, this isn't right. This person should not feel this way. So I wanted to know, how is it that you felt that this was the right course of action? You know?
Did you ever get a response from her?
Yeah. All the abuses, she claimed all the abuse was real, that people were trying to get her. People were just smearing her name.
Okay. So she holds true to her lies till the very end.
At least what she told me. Yeah. I don't know what she's telling other people. I haven't had any communication with her since then. I found out about this. I found out about the when I reached out to her, it was a few years ago, after I did an interview with a guy who was writing a book. And I had heard of, I didn't have a lot of information, but I'd heard that they had found gigs of child pornography on Dr. Schwartz's computer during the course of the investigation. And for years, I held on to that. Like, okay, even if he wasn't trying to kill her, clearly something was going on because they said this pornography looked just like Clara.
Yeah.
For years I held on to this. It was the one thing that kept me from thinking that I was a complete and utter freaking monster. You know? Was that no matter how screwed up she was or how screwed up how everything went, at least there's this person who's got that kind of mindset. No longer able to get to victimize anybody.
Yeah.
And through the course of this, he was like, so, you know, how do you feel about the fact that, you know, her, you know, this, all this stuff was put on his, appeared on his hard drive 2 weeks before you killed him? And it felt like the entire the entire world just disappeared out from underneath my feet. I mean, yeah. God, that sounds so trite, but I mean, that's no other way to put it. I remember everything in my head just going silent, like just dead stop when he told me that. Yeah. When he asked me that question, it was like, how do I feel about the fact that, or how do I explain that the, all this pornography showed up on his hard drive 2 weeks before he died?
Do you talk to any of the co-defendants, you know, Katie or Michael now?
I have absolutely no intention of ever talking to Katie again, even if I had the opportunity. She essentially threw Mike under the bus to save her own damn skin. And Michael, thank the gods, he is free. He's completed his sentence, but in terms of his probation, he cannot have any communication with me, for which I do not blame him, and have not sought to seek him out.
Okay.
He's got a chance at a real life now. And I really hope that his life is infinitely better now.
We do too. What about Dungeons and Dragons and fantasy role-playing games? Like, where do you stand on this now?
The fact is, one of the things that I hated most about this whole case, aside from what actually happened, like the fallout, was the light that this cast on role-playing games and Wicca, witchcraft in general. Because back then, 17 years ago, I was a nutcase. I didn't know what the hell I was doing half the time. You know, I thought that I did. If you'd asked me back then, I was, you know, king shit on Turtle Hill. Oh, am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
Okay, cool. I didn't know how, if the people had the censor button ready to go or not. Elliot in the Morning got fined because of a couple of things I said back in 2002. So, sorry, guys. Back then, I thought I couldn't tell the difference between anything. I really couldn't. I thought I did. You know, back then, I was so far out there, I can't even believe some of the stuff. I look back at the reports and stuff I said and the things I did, and I couldn't believe it. I didn't even know what Wicca was back then, but I thought I did.
Okay.
As how Wicca stands, witchcraft, and I'll get into the role-playing games in a second, I am a devout Wiccan. I am a member of the Rowan Tree Church, and I'm very happy to say that I've earned the certificate of lay minister for the Rowan Tree Church. I'm not clergy, but you know, I've studied a lot. I've done a lot of self-improvement. I had to complete an entire prisoner, you know, outreach course before they even let me become a member of the church. Mm. Like they were very, very dedicated to the idea of people can change. People have a right to change if they want to. And their entire course was designed to show growth as a person. So it's Reverend Paul Byrell and Reverend Jerry Byrell. They're the, you know, they've changed my life for the better. I am a much better person since I became a member of the church and was studying and bettering my life. As for role-playing games, the same with witchcraft and, you know, when the cases happened, aside from this underworld crap that Clara was pushing, Dungeons and Dragons had absolutely nothing to do with this case. Nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't, you know, killing a guy because I thought he was a hobgoblin or something. It had nothing to do with that. And I hate, because of all the history that's, you know, the villainization and demonizing of games like Dungeons and Dragons have suffered, I hated that something that I liked so much got thrown into the mix like that.
Okay.
You know, got associated with it. It's actually the pastime that me and my brothers use in here on a near daily basis. You know, it's how we pass the time in here. Mm. And there's a very distinct line between fantasy and reality. You know, we know when we're in game, we know when we're out of game, and there's no blurring of that line. You know, and it's, believe it or not, it's a great way to work on your social skills. You know, it really is, because it requires a lot of creative thinking. It requires a lot of discussion in game, problem solving that requires your words, not just saying I'm rolling the dice and attacking some damn thing.
Okay.
It's I mean, it's how we pass the time. It allows us to create a bubble around us that doesn't include any of the negative crap that goes on around here. We don't have anything to do with, you know, saying the negative aspects of, you know, life in prison. We keep to ourselves and, you know, we're well liked by everybody. Nobody bothers us.
That's kind of cool. You have your own, like, D&D club.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Nerd alert, for sake of clarification, we play Pathfinder. You know, we left D&D behind when they made the mistake of jumping the 4th edition and never forgave them for it since. So, there you go. There's your nerdgasm for the day.
There we go. Oh, man.
God, Wizards of the Coast is going to hate me. Next question.
I just kind of wanted to know if there was anything else you wanted to address or to tell us or to
that we
talk about.
Asked you.
Well, I do, but I'm going to have to call you right back because that disembodied bitch is about to cut in again. All right.
So, really, we're at the point. Whatever you want to talk about, whatever you want to kind of say, we want to, you know, give you a few minutes to put a button on it.
All right. Well, I think the one thing that I really want to get across, you know, and it's important to me that I say this where people can hear it. I've never taken any pleasure in what happened. You know, it's not something to be proud of. Anytime I discuss it with other people, it's, you know, I always call it, you know, the tragedy, capital T. You know, because this was a tragedy. The world lost somebody they really needed. And I've never shied away from my responsibility in it, you know, regarding, you know, saying, setting aside all of the talk of being insane, you know, being, you know, schizophrenic and mentally screwed up or whatever, I've never shied away from, it was my hand that wields that sword, and that is not, and that, I've never denied it, not once. Because it would be disrespectful and extreme for me to deny it. To Dr. Schwartz, to his family. I don't know if you guys heard that behind me. You can cut that part if you need to.
What just happened? Sorry.
They just announced cell break behind me. I didn't know if you guys heard it or not.
We heard something. Over the,
yeah, that's periodic. You're about to hear the doors opening and closing here in a second. But I'm not a monster. You know, there are still people who think I'm a monster. You know, and I don't really blame them, but I have worked incessantly these last 17 plus years to be somebody worthy of getting a second chance at life. Mm-hmm. Because it's never been in question. I was given a shit deck from day one, and I have played the best hands I can. Okay, and I've done the best with every single thing I've been given. And sometimes my best just wasn't enough. Okay. I spent, you know, from the time I was, you know, by the time they, you know, I was 3, they started doping me with medications that were never supposed to be given to a children. Mm-hmm. You know, but child psychopharmacology was not, you know, was not then what it is now. They didn't know any better. But a lot of my problems stemmed from the fact they'd give me so much medication, my system became dependent on it, so I couldn't function without it. Mm-hmm. In a lot of these psychiatric facilities, there's a lot of these places, you're just a number. You're just a case number.
Mm-hmm.
When I see a psychiatrist here, as long as I can tell them I'm not thinking about hurting myself or anybody around me and that I'm still taking my medication, nothing else matters to them. Okay? Mm. There are people who... There are children in psychiatric facilities today that are not being treated. They're being warehoused. The psychiatric system of America is a beast. It is a huge, hungering beast, and I'm the product of that. I'm an example of what happens when that beast has weight and is gone unchecked. medication is not the answer. It's not just medication. It's therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I have worked incessantly these last 17 years with every bit of resource I can get my hands on to be a better person, to be a real person. You know, back then I was such a hollow shell of a imitation of a person, and I didn't even know it. I look back at that stuff now, and I'm like, how the hell did anybody not bum rush me with a straitjacket back then? You know? I read the reports, and I'm like, how the hell does anybody not see this coming? My dad saw it coming, and he told them. He told them not to let me go, and they did anyways. You don't give a known psychotic 3 months of prescription and a bus ticket to Northern Virginia and say, oh, he's going to be fine. He's going to keep taking his medication on his own. He's going to go check in to see a psychiatrist every month, just like he's supposed to, even though he doesn't have a car or any place he can actually call home. Everything's going to be just fine. You don't do that.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah, unfortunately, that happens whether, you know, you're inside the system or outside the system, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, and now all I'm doing now is I'm fighting for a better life. You know, obviously I don't want to die in here, you know, but it would be irresponsible for me to be set free without making sure there were safeguards in place, you know, and making sure that I've taken the time to show that I can actually function. And if I had to spend the rest of my life in a psychiatric facility, at least I'm getting therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Because living in prison with psychiatric, with the kind of problems I have, medication or not, is fucking torture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There are days where I don't want to function. I don't want to be awake because the stuff in my head gets just so damn loud. And there's only so much you can talk to the psychiatrist about before they put your ass in the hole. So you have to shut your mouth about some of these things. You know? It's one of those, I can talk to a person who's not going to do anything about it but make my situation worse. Or, you know, I can tell them about it and find my way itself in the hole where it's going to be worse and find, you know, saying, or I can just suffer.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Kyle,
you know,
we wanted to thank you for taking the time to speak with us, to be so vulnerable and honest and candid.
Yeah.
You know, we hear your struggles and we acknowledge them, and there's not a tremendous amount we can do besides say that, you know, we recognize that mental health is a serious issue.
And I feel like listening to your story, I got very emotional because, you know, I have a family member who has mental illness, very serious mental illness. And I just think that I just imagine if he didn't have his family and if he didn't have support,
mm-hmm.
you know, what would happen to him? And even with family and with support, it was
hard.
So difficult and unbearable. And so I can just imagine what it's like when you don't have family and you don't have support
or,
you know,
resources.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're tearing up. Sorry, Kyle.
Sorry. You try it again.
Well, thank you. We just, you know, thank you for your transparency, for your candor. You know,
thank you for giving me an opportunity to tell my story.
Of course,
you know,
of course.
I've never shied away from talking about it, but, you know, saying I never wanted to talk about it for ratings or sensationalism. You know, I've actually turned down several offers in the past because of the fact I'd seen some of the stuff that they show, you know, or, you know, a little-known fact about, you know, the producers of different places they've written to me. I have friends who will look them up online. And, you know, I've turned down people because I don't want some shock value, you know, shock value stuff, you know, it's not, he deserves more than that.
Mm-hmm.
you guys giving me an opportunity to tell my story, and I want people to know that this isn't something to be proud of. This isn't something, you know, and if, even if it's too late for me, even if I spend the rest of my life in prison, you know, my one real hope from this is that there's somebody out there listening right now who, like you, has friends, has family, who is having mental health issues and starts paying attention to what's actually being done to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll post resources as well on our social media and website. We'll absolutely.
Say again?
We'll post resources for people on our social media and website. So if someone does find themselves in that situation, they can seek help, and they can hopefully remedy that situation.
Okay, that's fantastic. That's amazing. I mean, that's what they, I mean, as much as you've shown me these last year and a half, Bethany, I'm sure that, you know, the people that you're putting up, the resources you're putting up, they're going to be helpful, and mm-hmm. I'm happy to hear it. If this interview, if this helps anybody, I'm happy. You know, I'm not getting anything out of this other than being able to tell my story and air my apology. That's really the only thing I cared about. You know, remember it's the first thing I told you, Bethany, when we first started talking was, if I do this, are you going to make sure people know how I really feel about all this? Yeah. That's all I wanted. And I appreciate that.
Well, I hope you enjoyed getting to meet Adriana, and you can see she's a real person. He's always like,
yeah.
Whatever he calls you, and I'm not with you.
I don't know. There are moments of concern for me because she just talked an awful lot about you, but you just never seem to be there, Adriana.
She was like,
you know, so
you find out later that I'm like a pet macaw or something.
Yeah. No, I'm just trusting that Bethany here is not just some really, really skilled ventriloquist. I watch America's Got Talent. I've seen what she's doing.
She is very small, so.
I mean, I've seen a couple of them. You know, one of them had a puppet on there singing while she was singing. So, you know, I wouldn't put it past people.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, thank
you. So thank you for having me. I'm glad I can make you laugh. I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to put the stuff out there for people to hear.
100%.
And I hope that it helps. At the end of the day, I just hope that it helps.
Well, thank you. And take care. We'll be speaking soon.
I absolutely will.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in again to The Pros and Cons. And thank you so much, Kyle Hulbert, for being willing to come on our show and being so open about what we think is a very important topic that doesn't
Absolutely.
Get spoken about very often. You can get in touch with us in several ways, especially if you want to talk about this episode. You can email us at thepros and cons podcast@gmail.com. You can follow us at The Pros and Cons Show on Twitter and The Pros and Cons Podcast on both Instagram and Facebook. And please remember to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts and or your favorite Android app. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Before we sign off, I just wanted to tell you about a new podcast I'm executive producing called The Intersection of Cancer and Life. It is hosted by my dear friend, Emily Garnett, who was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer in November 2017. Emily and her guests discuss the changes, challenges, and unexpected shifts that have occurred while living with cancer. These conversations emphasize the fact that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to rebuilding a life after diagnosis, and lets listeners know that they are not alone, whether they themselves have been diagnosed with cancer or have a friend or loved one navigating treatment. You can listen to the first season now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and your favorite podcast app by searching for The Intersection of Cancer and Life.